Biden's first trip to West Asia region next month, during which he will visit the occupied Palestine, followed by a trip to Saudi Arabia. Israel's foreign minister has said that his country was looking to Biden's trip next month to help improve relations with Saudi Arabia.
U.S. President Joe Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh summit. Biden says he will be focusing on Israel as a key issue for talks during his Saudi visit. Palestinians, on the other hand, say the Biden's visit to the region would only be symbolic. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask... the milk producers in Northern Ireland, how he or she can produce the milk, one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently, just 15% of UK exports go to the US. And according to analysts, it would take years for London and Washington to agree on a new trade deal. EU leaders simply do not trust the British government any longer. Analysts have been surprised by the bloc's unity throughout the Brexit process after the EU spelled out its red lines.
And the EU has been very consistent in keeping to those red lines, probably more unified than anyone expected. Whereas on the other side, we have seen huge divisions.
This protocol presents for Northern Ireland.
It's been suggested, for political reasons, Johnson cannot back down now, and therefore it would ultimately require a change of government in London to avoid a trade war. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Grounded right before takeoff from a military airport in southwest England, as the legal wrangling over the fate of those due to be deported played out. The crew of the £500,000 taxpayer-funded flight to Rwanda soon realized they weren't going anywhere, as an 11th-hour intervention by the European Human Rights Council granted a reprieve to most of the seven Middle Eastern asylum seekers on board, to the delight of critics of the government's immigration policy.
I was delighted. It really instilled my confidence in the judicial system, that people could actually pick out favourable politics and look behind that and identify potential breaches of human rights.
A defiant UK Prime Minister, though, says he is pushing on with his policy and that he may now contemplate withdrawing from the European Convention on Human Rights.
What we want to do is to show the people traffickers that they're breaking the law, they're risking people's lives, and it won't work anyway. Now, will it be necessary to change some laws to help us as we go along? It may very well be.
At the moment, the UK's Interior Ministry forcibly removes anyone it deems inadmissible to claim asylum in the UK on a one-way charter flight to Rwanda, and houses them at facilities like this one in the capital, Kigali. A policy that has drawn fierce criticism from charities to the Church of England to rights activists.
Well, the government argument is they're doing this to put people traffickers out of business. But people such as yourself want the policy scrapped altogether. Why?
Immigration, asylum and human rights are not at the top of the priority of this government's way of working with others, you know, less fortunate than themselves. We see the situation in Rwanda as being dressed up as something that it's absolutely not. I still have clients who are Rwandan refugees.
the UK has reportedly paid cash-strapped Rwanda $148 million upfront for the deportation deal and plans on making additional payments to the East African country based on the number of asylum seekers it deports.
The UK government says it's ready to do anything, including changing the law to make those deportation flights happen. But for now, a respite for desperate asylum seekers facing a terrifying future. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Senior U.S. advisor for energy security Amos Hochstein met high-ranking Lebanese officials in Beirut. During the talks, Lebanese officials said conditions for talks are confidential, but stressed their main demand is Lebanon maintain its right to defend its natural resources.
For the Lebanese government, the point 29 will be considered as a negotiation point, and the 23 point will be considered as the realistic point that will draw the Lebanese borders over the sea.
The conflict over petrol and gas fields began more than 10 years ago when the U.S. proposed a so-called Hough Line, which is lower than Line 23, stripping Lebanon of some 860 square kilometers. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister Mikati, and Speaker Nabih Berri all stressed a unified stance for Lebanon that the country will not concede its right to begin drilling offshore.
Because of the American embargo over on Lebanon, we cannot drill for our rights to extract our gas and oil because we have to be delayed until the Israeli and the Zionist entity to extract their wealth before us. Therefore, the American negotiator is taken aside, and it's very obvious that they are not negotiating for our benefit, but for the benefit of our enemy.
A recent move by Israel to attempt drilling in the Karish field, which falls within Line 29, has led to opposition from Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has also warned the floating petrol company Energean against drilling in that area as long as it is disputed, and also cautioned that Israeli drilling could reach depths closer to potentially gas-rich Lebanese fields. Lebanon's main dilemma now is that time is running out and its natural resources could be looted at any time. Analysts believe the officials need to firstly demand that the U.S. lift its undeclared blockade and allow contracted companies to implement their obligations and drill in purely Lebanese fields. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The battle for Donbass. Russia has air and artillery superiority. By some accounts, they are pounding Ukrainian positions with 50,000 shells a day. Particularly terrifying are their thermobaric missiles. They cause massive fireballs and suck out the oxygen from the surrounding air. The Ukrainians are well dug in places. These weapons can penetrate their trenches with devastating effect. The Guardian newspaper reports that between 600 and 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers are being killed or wounded every day. A horrific loss of human life and strategically unsustainable. The Russians, too, are thought to have had high casualties. It has been a long time since they have released their figures, but it is they who are moving forward slowly but surely. Peace talks broke down early on in the conflict. Both sides have had little interest in them since.
People have been dying here for years. We have thousands of infrastructure items destroyed. What about could we talk to Ukraine about now? And what Ukraine are we talking to? The one that is a terrorist state? There's no logic and no sense in negotiating with terrorists, for they'll be constantly changing their demands and trying to turn them in their favor. There have been negotiations from the beginning of liberation operation, and as you can see, it ends in nothing.
President Zelensky has made clear that he is not interested in talks unless Russia withdraws to the territory it held before February 24th. With Russia on the front foot on the battlefield, this will not happen.
We don't say this operation is against Ukraine, for it's actually NATO who are fighting against our republics now, the collective West. It's now some kind of front line of good and evil. That's why we might be ready to negotiate. The question is, what about? Ukraine has sold its people and its sovereignty to the West against the interest of its population. So these negotiations are with who and about what?
Now, just as Russia has massive political control over the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, so does NATO have huge political control over Ukraine. It arms them, it funds them, and so when negotiations start and what terms will be on offer in negotiations, we're very much down to NATO's decisions rather than the Ukrainian government's.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, recently said,
President Zelensky has stated many times this war will end at the negotiating table. The question is, what kind of position will the Ukrainians have when they negotiate a solution? Our responsibility is to make that position as strong as possible. We know that there is a very close link between what you can achieve at the negotiating table and your position on the battlefield. So our military support to them is a way to strengthen their hand.
Hundreds of soldiers, both Ukrainian and Russian, are being slaughtered every day in Donbass, so that their governments have a better hand at the negotiating table. Civilians on both sides are dying too. A mother and her 11-year-old child yesterday in Donetsk, killed by shelling of a market. Meanwhile, global leaders warn of a catastrophic global food crisis due to the conflict. Peace is still a long way off, and it looks set to be achieved on the battlefield. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The community and wider supporters gathered to remember the victims of the Grenfell Inferno 5 years on. Many had gathered in the shadow of the building that still stands as a constant reminder of June 14th, when an inferno engulfed the tower block, leaving scores dead and thousands of others impacted and the nation traumatized. Dignitaries, including politicians and royalty, paid their respects, and for all the acts of heroism during the blaze and in its aftermath, the scars still run deep.
From my perspective, I feel like it's like a Muslim tragedy in London because of the high number of Muslims that were living here, because it was during Ramadan, because of the impact that it's had on the local community. The very first person who was named was a Somalian Muslim out of the list of people who had died in Grenfell. And I think the continuation of our story right now has to be on recognising the impact it had on the community here and what more can we do now.
The reoccurring theme when you speak with people here is the sense of frustration and anger at the way in which survivors, victims, the community, members of their family were all treated and continue to be treated. The pledges that were made, the promises that were broken, and the spectre of another Grenfell being possible.
The official Grenfell inquiry, chaired by Sir Martin Moore-Bick, that so far lasted 4 years and cost £149 million and counting, is attempting to figure out what truly happened and who was responsible. Those still fighting for answers are clear about what justice will mean in this case.
Justice will look like the fact that those people, the leaseholders, people in social housing, you know, in high-rise blocks, are living in habitable, affordable, safe homes. That is what justice will look like on one hand, and on the other hand, as I've said before, justice should look like those who are accountable for, who are responsible for this atrocity, are held accountable.
What I would like to ask this government is, what is it going to take for them to start taking this issue seriously? Is it because the people who died in Grenfell Tower on that night were mostly working class people, were mostly people of colour? Because we know that had Grenfell been in Canary Wharf, that building would not have been covered in illegal flammable cladding. It's utterly outstanding that we're 5 years on, we still have no answers. This community has received no justice, and still there are residents in this country that are living in buildings covered in the same illegal flammable cladding that was wrapped around Grenfell Tower.
Ahead of any official findings, the community of Grenfell march. They remember, and they will continue the fight for answers and justice. Amina Taylor, London.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq war dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot Report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saeed Burizup, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. and I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
To Spotlight. Palestinians have held a funeral ceremony for three men shot dead by Israeli forces during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the West Bank. Nearly 80 Palestinians were also wounded in the ensuing clashes. Resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes, and the Israeli measures will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance. Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. Jenin is the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. The Palestinian Health Ministry says more than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces this year, many of them in raids, incursions, and arbitrary killings by the Israeli army. On tonight's Spotlight, we have... Johannesburg. And also we have international coordinator of the Samarin Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Ahmad Mayet in Johannesburg. Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. How do you view the recent wave of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians?
The situation in Palestine must be understood through two lenses, the first being the regional lens and the second being the domestic lens. The regional lens is very clear. Israel is still trying very hard to reestablish something called the deterrence equation. Israel was developed on the principle of deterrence, meaning the fear of the Arabs around them, and they thrive on this using excessive force. It was seen in Lebanon, in Dahiya, and they are trying very hard to reestablish that regional deterrence equation with the current activity with the gas platform off the coast of Lebanon. However, on the domestic front, Israel has somewhat reset the deterrence equation that was established by Saif al-Quds, the military operation, the 11-day operation that was waged against Israel in defense of Jerusalem. What we are seeing now, the massacres that are taking place within the occupied West Bank, the portion of Palestine occupied by Israel, with security cooperation by the Palestinian Authority, is a means of appeasing the Israeli population that they are doing something. And this is not my words. This is from Oded Parlov, who works for the INSS, who works for the Israeli Foreign Affairs Department, and is an advisor to the sellout states, the Arab states that have normalized ties with Israel. They are saying that this has no true effect on what they call their security concerns. It's merely a means of appeasing the Israeli population. Basically, Palestinian lives are being sacrificed to put smiles on occupier colonial settler faces. That's the summary of the situation.
Charlotte Cates, Jenin has been the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. Also, there were some reprisal attacks, if you recall, against Israelis in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations as Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Well, it's very clear that despite 74 years, and indeed over 74 years, of Zionist colonialism inside occupied Palestine, what the occupation has failed to do through all of that time is to crush Palestinian resistance. And so we see that today. Certainly we see that in Gaza, where the resistance is perhaps stronger than it has ever been throughout the history of the Palestinian revolutionary movement. And it's also something that we see in Jenin. And Jenin, in many ways, has become a very dangerous symbol to the Israeli occupation, because the purpose of creating the so-called Palestinian Authority was to create a security coordination process and a tool, an agent of the colonizer to repress the resistance on behalf of the colonial force. And what we can see 30 years after Oslo is that this has entirely failed in quashing the will of the people to resist, and that despite all forms of assassination, torture, mass imprisonment, targeting, extrajudicial killings, that over and over again, the Palestinian people and their resistance organizations continue to rebuild, continue to mobilize. And so the mere existence of the Jenin brigades, of this ongoing strength and power of the armed resistance in Jenin, which comes hand in hand with all of the various forms of popular resistance practiced by the Palestinian people, it shows that Zionism has never been able to crush Palestinian resistance and will never be able to crush Palestinian resistance. And so these attempts to sort of wipe out the resistance by taking Palestinian lives, by imposing trauma and devastation on families and loved ones and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and wives and husbands and children of the martyrs, this is an exercise of brutality. This is an exercise of colonial violence and colonial brutality. But what it has never done and never will do is silence the message and the vision of these martyrs and all of those who continue to fight, which is for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea.
Ahmad Mayed, resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes and the Israeli measures will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance against the regime. Will these Israeli crimes make Palestinians more united in the face of the occupation?
Yes, I agree with the sentiments that have been expressed by Hamas. The attacks against the populations of Jenin, if you look in 2022, of the 70 Palestinians that have been martyred thus far, approximately we're looking at round about 27, I would say, are from Jenin alone. Jenin was always the heart of resistance during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. It was Ariel Sharon, Arik Schreinemann, who called Jenin the cockroach's nest and was renamed by the Palestinians as the nest of angels. It has been the core of resistance. In April, it was 20 years since the Jenin massacre. And now Israel is sitting with a very difficult problem. How do they show to their population that they're doing something without sparking a massive regional war. They can't go to Gaza. It is very clear from Saif al-Quds that the escalation, according to them, was not visible through any forms of intelligence or any forms of prediction. And therefore, they're quite afraid of escalating in Gaza, the usual stomping ground of the IDF. So they're trying to do it with periodic attacks into Jenin. And like my colleague has said, is that Jenin is now a symbol of resistance for the Palestinian people because Israel has also taken some casualties during their raids into Jenin. What we have, and the key to this problem, is the cooperation, the security cooperation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli regime. It's not very different from what was happening here in apartheid South Africa and the Bantustans, and that is why you had people like Chris Hani, was the leader of the SACP and the chief of staff of Mkhonto we Sizwe, the armed movement of the ANC, together with Ronnie Kasrils in September of 1992, fighting against these puppets of the apartheid regime, saying that they have to remove the parasites. The key to this resistance in the West Bank is to remove the security cooperation with the Israeli state and remove the puppets from their seats. They are working as agents of Israel, and it has not worked in South Africa. They were removed, and this is what needs to happen on the ground in Palestine.
Charlie Cates, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also reacted to the recent events. It called on the International Criminal Court to investigate crimes committed by Israeli forces and settlers. Will that ever happen, in your opinion, given the staunch support that the Israelis have from the United States? How can the status quo ever change, in your opinion?
When these crimes are carried out by Israeli occupation forces, it's important to note that these are not Israeli crimes alone. These are not just the crimes of the Zionist regime. These are crimes that are fully funded and backed and supported by the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the governments of the European Union, the governments that not only continue to provide weaponry and advanced technology to the Israeli occupation, but continue to engage in security coordination with it, continue to list Palestinian organizations and Palestinian resistance movements as terrorist organizations, despite the fact that what they are doing is a legitimate exercise of resistance in defense of a colonized people seeking liberation. These governments are part and parcel of the criminal project. They are responsible for these war crimes. So in many ways, if we are expecting, the current governments in the U.S. and Canada and Europe to take the lead in prosecuting Israeli occupation, that's something that we may have a long time to wait for. But what we do see is that within these countries, the people of these countries actually don't agree with what their governments are doing. We see when we look at last year in May 2021 during Saif al-Quds and the Unity Intifada, what did we see in the cities of the world? Tens of thousands of people pouring into the streets in the heart of the empire to say, we stand with Palestine, no more Israeli apartheid, no more Israeli crimes, no to Zionism, no to racism. And so the fact is that it is very essential, especially for those of us who are in these countries and working to organize for Palestine, to do everything that we can to put meaningful and powerful pressure on these states to cut off the flow of military, diplomatic, economic, and political support and impunity that is being given to the Israeli occupation regime. And so in terms of the International Criminal Court, there are many very distinguished and committed Palestinian and international lawyers that are working to pursue this there. But what we see instead from much of the leadership of the International Criminal Court is an interest in pursuing only African leaders and those who are on the other side from imperialist powers, rather than actually pursuing the major perpetrators of injustice in the world, who are these very imperialist powers who are standing in line with the Israeli occupation state. And so unfortunately, for far too long, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry, rather than representing the interests of the Palestinian people, has continue to engage in a strategy that seeks to essentially give in to the U.S. and Europe, despite the fact that those powers are funding, promoting, and supporting Zionist colonization in Palestine. The first step that any Palestinian Authority entity can take is to bring an end immediately to the security coordination process, which is putting the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people in danger on a daily basis.
Ahmed Mayet, an analyst that we spoke to here on Press TV earlier, also believes that the Palestinians have every right to fight the Israeli occupation and they should be supported in their struggle. You agree with that notion, of course. Are Palestinians receiving the support that they need? And if not, how can that support be enhanced?
The right to resist an occupation is an international law right. That right, if we want to look at any other precedent, South Africa was the perfect precedent. We had the armed struggle here under Mkhonto we Sizwe and many other movements. In fact, when Chris Hani was assassinated, the chief of staff of Mkhonto we Sizwe, it was the speech of the first democratically elected president of South Africa, the late Nelson Mandela, who said that it's not a question of armed resistance or negotiations. At the time, they were negotiating with the apartheid regime for the end of this horrendous form of governance. He said it's not a decision between armed resistance and negotiations. It is armed resistance that brought the Afrikaner apartheid government to the negotiating table. Therefore, it's indicative of the fact that you cannot exclude the armed resistance from the equation, which many are trying to do through different means. And this is the very serious threat that is now presenting itself. Armed resistance is a cornerstone of the Palestinian movement. It is the key to the liberation of Palestine. We've had negotiations for many years, and what has that produced? It's produced eaten up Palestinian land, more settlements, further oppression, and periodic attacks against the Palestinians. What we have now is an axis of resistance stretching all the way from the borders of Pakistan, going through into Afghanistan. You have the Islamic Republic of Iran that has bolstered the Palestinians' ability to defend themselves and to actually stand up and assert their rights. And that is what we saw with Saif al-Quds. We saw the reclamation of dignity, and this axis has gone far beyond. It's gone to Iraq. It is on the borders of Syria, looking into Golan. We have it in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and we have it in the south with Gaza and even far as Ansarullah in Yemen. The armed resistance is going to be the key to the liberation of the Palestinian people, as together with movements such as boycott, divestment, and sanction, and more so not the movement, but rather the tool of boycott, divestment, and sanction, and global support. However, we cannot shy away from the right of oppressed people to defend themselves. This is not an offensive war, it's a defensive war. And I think that reality is very clear. It was proven in South Africa, and it is now proven in Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, more land confiscations and evictions are taking place by the Israelis. It was just announced yesterday, if I'm correct, that the regime is planning to confiscate a vast swath of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, around 1,000 square kilometers of Palestinian territory from Al-Quds all the way to the Dead Sea in what's being viewed as its largest expansionist program. Under international law, we know the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Human Rights Watch, for example, has said on numerous occasions that Israel's policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. And why are these policies still continuing then?
These policies are continuing because they are being funded and backed by very powerful imperialist states. The Israeli occupation regime, the Zionist project in Palestine, would cease to exist if U.S. imperialism cut off the endless flow of money and protective support that it provides to this project. And in fact, this is something that the Zionist Project is very concerned about. When we see all of these propaganda campaigns, campaigns of criminalization, campaigns of targeting Palestine organizing in the United States and internationally, one of the reasons for this is that it's very clear that young people, that progressive people, that people in general who want to see a more just world and a just society to recognize that Zionism is racism, and that Israeli settler colonialism, that Zionist colonization of Palestine is something that simply cannot be part of a just world and a just society. And so for those of us that are working for justice outside occupied Palestine, one of the most important things that we can do is everything that we can to put pressure on these governments that are continuing to fund, support, and arm the occupation regime, to hold them accountable for their crimes against the Palestinian people, and to organize to defend the Palestinian people and their resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. Because the Palestinian resistance is on the front lines fighting back, not just for the liberation of Palestine, but really for a just and democratic future for humanity, sure, which is something that cannot coexist with apartheid, settler colonialism, occupation, and oppression.
Ahmed Maed, you heard the plans, the most recent plans of the Israeli regime of more land confiscations. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of an independent Palestinian state in the future?
The framework has changed drastically from a two-state discussion to a one-state reality. The Israeli confiscations of large tracts of land right now is an attempt to establish facts on the ground so that when they are forced to the table to discuss the dismantlement of the state, they have more to deal with than being put into a position where they are forced to accept the precepts of international law. What is happening now within the human rights discourse is that the very foundations of Israel is being questioned. You have it from Human Rights Watch, you have it from Amnesty International, and you have it from B'Tselem, to name a few. The establishment of the state of Israel was based on the principles of terror, it was based on ethnic superiority, and it is a state that favors only one group of people. It is hardly democratic, its very foundations are flawed, and therefore it has to be dismantled. Israel knows this, and this is why Israel is acting in the manner it is acting. It is very similar to the manner in which the apartheid regime behaved towards the end of its life. Israel is now facing a situation where the military equation has changed, because any attempt to jihadize the precincts of Masjid al-Aqsa and Jerusalem al-Quds will now create a regional war. And that regional war will overwhelm Israel. In fact, this is the latest statements from the Israeli military leaders. They are aware of that. And therefore, they are trying to gain whatever advantage they can by stealing tracts of land, by building settlements, etc., in a gray zone principle, meaning that they are trying to push the parameters as far as they can without sparking a war. This is gray zone tactics from Israel, but the time is, the clock is rather ticking, and Israel is running out of time. It's very, very clear. This is not our comments. This is not from a pro-Palestinian or Palestinian supporter comment. It is a situation that is coming out from Israeli military reports. They are saying that this is not a sustainable project, and apartheid was not sustainable, colonialism was not sustainable, and the Israeli Zionist project is not sustainable. It is basically the end of Israel, and these are the last kicks of a dying horse.
All right, that brings us to an end here on this edition of our program. Allow me to thank my guests, attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Maed, joining us from Johannesburg, and thanks to international coordinator Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
After a white 18-year-old teenager wearing military gear and live streaming with a helmet camera opened fire with a rifle at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and wounding 3 others, U.S. President Joe Biden claimed racially motivated hate crime was abhorrent to the very fabric of the nation. We now present you an article written by Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Mass Shooting Comes Amid Rise in Racial Violence in United States." The story is by now nauseatingly familiar. From Charleston to El Paso, Texas. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to San Diego, California. And from Christchurch, New Zealand to the latest scene of horror in Buffalo, New York. Each of these mass shootings is stitched with one common thread: white supremacy. As investigators begin to piece together the details of last Saturday, May 14th, massacre at the Tops Friendly Market that killed 10 people, the motivation of the murderer already seems in little doubt. The perpetrator appears to be a radicalized, lone, white teenage gunman, filled with racial hatred fueled by extremist theory widely available on the internet, who descended on a predominantly black community in Buffalo, New York, heavily armed and determined to kill as many people as he could. The suspect, Peyton Gendron, an 18-year-old teenager, is said to have etched a racial insult onto the barrel of his assault rifle before he live-streamed himself gunning down grocery shoppers, supermarket staff, and a security guard. Authorities said he also posted a lengthy manifesto to social media with frequent references to a racist white replacement theory as justification for what they said was a hate crime and a racially motivated violent extremism. U.S. President Joe Biden, scores of American politicians and community and civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, were quick to express their outrage, calling for more to be done to tackle the rise in hate-based crime in the United States. In a statement, President Biden said, "We still need to learn more about the motivation for the shooting as law enforcement does its work, but we don't need anything else to state a clear moral truth. A racially motivated hate crime is abhorrent to the very fabric of this nation." President Biden said, "Any act of domestic terrorism, including an act perpetrated in the name of a repugnant white nationalist ideology, is antithetical to everything we stand for in America. Hate must have no safe harbor. We must do everything in our power to end hate-fueled domestic terrorism." But it's a problem that has been getting worse in recent years, largely cultivated in the cauldron of the darkest reaches of the internet and eagerly seized upon by those all too willing to convert the skewed ideology into violence. The FBI reported last year that the hate crimes in the United States had risen to the highest level in 12 years, triggered largely by a surge in assaults on Black and Asian Americans. And while mass murderers such as those in Buffalo, New York, and elsewhere understandably garnered the most attention, many thousands of other violent hate-based attacks take place each year, leading Attorney General Merrick Garland to make domestic terrorism and racially based hate crimes a top priority for the Justice Department. Derek Johnson, president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, said in a statement following the Buffalo, New York attack, "Hate and racism have no place in America. We are shattered, extremely angered, and praying for the victims' families and loved ones, as well as the entire community." The parallels of Buffalo are significant not only to the August 2019 murder of 21 people at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas, but also to countless other shooting incidents involving a radicalized, solitary attacker. In El Paso, Texas, the gunman, a 21-year-old white male, also posted a document online to extremist online message board 8chan. Which stated the attack in the border town was a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. 4 years earlier, an attack on a Black community church by a self-confessed white supremacist in Charleston, South Carolina, left at least 9 people dead. In October of 2018 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a white man shouted, "All of you must die," as he burst into the Tree of Life synagogue and shot dead 11 worshippers, as well as wounding 6 other individuals. And a similar mass shooting incident occurred at a synagogue in San Diego, California, in April of 2019, when one person died and several others were wounded by a 19-year-old teenager who also posted messages of racial hatred to 8chan. The San Diego killer claimed he was motivated by attacks on 2 mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, a month earlier, in which a white supremacist murdered 51 Muslims. Investigators there quickly established the killer had been radicalized online, had posted his own manifesto of hatred, and live-streamed the killings. To Reverend Al Sharpton, the veteran civil rights activist and television host, the latest attack in Buffalo, New York, is an urgent call to action. Reverend Al Sharpton said in a tweet, "President Biden should have a White House meeting of Black, Jewish, and Asian leaders to underscore the federal government's escalating efforts against hate crimes." Reverend Al Sharpton added, "These hate crimes need to be met with a united front against hate-based violence." Meanwhile, the mayor of Buffalo, New York, said on Sunday, 15th of May, he believed the murders in his city will prove a turning point. Byron Brown said on NBC's Meet the Press program, he said, "I would like to see sensible gun control in America. I would like to see ending hate speech on the internet, on social media. It is not free speech. It is not the American way." The mayor of Buffalo, New York, Byron Brown, claimed, "We are not a nation of haters. We are not a nation of hate. We need to send a message that there is no place in the internet for hate speech, for hate indoctrination, for spreading hate manifestos. I will be a stronger voice for that. I believe that what happened in Buffalo, New York yesterday is going to be a turning point. I think it's going to be different after this in terms of the energy and the activity that we see."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.